From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Floating format tonight, this hour, we begin with our main guest, Jim Mars, above top secret. Then later, an exclusive live interview as we go to Egypt with the head of antiquities, Zahi Hawass. Tonight should be a classic Coast to Coast show. Hey, don't forget to subscribe to your free Coast Zone newsletter. Thousands of you are signing up, but thousands of you probably don't know about this yet. So all you have to do is go to the coasttocoastam.com website. Right there on the homepage, just register for free. It is a free newsletter. As I said, free today, free tomorrow, free forever. It's yours. You'll get daily information on Coast to Coast, information about guests, special recap written by Lex Lonehood, webmaster. Take advantage of it. A free newsletter as our way of saying thank you for listening to Coast AM. The U.S. government is prepared to lend more than $7.4 trillion. Is this a mistake? No. On behalf of you, or half the value of everything produced in the nation last year, to rescue the financial system since the credit market seized up to 15 months ago. The unprecedented pledge of funds includes $2.8 trillion already tapped by financial institutions in the biggest response to an economic emergency since the New Deal of the 1930s. The commitment dwarfs the only plan approved by lawmakers. That's the Treasury Department's $700 billion troubled asset relief program. Federal Reserve lending last week was 1,900 times the weekly average for the 3 years before the crisis. And rescuing Citigroup, that's what the government's going to do, agreeing to shoulder hundreds of billions of dollars in possible losses at the stricken bank and to plow a fresh $20 billion into the company. Regulators hope that dramatic action will bolster badly shaken confidence in the once mighty banking giant, as well as the nation's financial system, a goal that so far has been elusive despite a flurry of government interventions to battle the worst global crisis since the 1930s. The stock of Citigroup soared today with news of this bailout. Andy Goss, of course, is an expert on the American and international banking systems, publishing a newsletter and has authored two books. Andy, this situation here, bailing out Citigroup, I thought they were okay. I thought they had enough assets. What happened?
Well, you know, in reality, Citigroup was probably in more trouble than any institution. They were at the top of our banks to watch list in our March newsletter.
So here we go with more money. And again, you said on this program it's going to cost lots more than the $700 billion. And here we are trickling into the trillions now.
Indeed. And if you look at the money multiplier, what's interesting to note here is that all of this bailout money thus far has been given to the banks on the equity side of the balance sheet. In other words, instead of saying, we're going to loan you $25 billion, what they've said is, here's $25 billion in capital that you can put on your books as equity.
So they're doing this with Citigroup. What other banks are out there that they're going to have to help bail them?
Goldman Sachs became a bank so that it could receive TARP funds. J.P. Morgan, you know what? If you want to just skip to the bottom line, it's the nine primary owners of the New York Federal Reserve Bank.
They're taking care of themselves.
That's right. It is the lead institution that got us into this mess. I've said it before, I don't understand why we don't nationalize the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It should get the same treatment that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac got, because it led us into the very same territory. We're absorbing now what is estimated to be $7.4 trillion in potential losses as a result of the poor supervision and bad management at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And I don't know if you caught this, George, but the guy who's the president of that private institution is going to be elevated to the Secretary of Treasury under the new administration.
I saw that. I saw that indeed, Andy. All around this country right now, people are listening to this radio program, and they're saying, where is this money coming from?
Well,
all this money.
Yeah.
Where is it coming from?
This maneuver was brilliant. And, you know, you got to give these guys credit. If you look at the Fed borrowing, and now we're talking about the Treasury for a moment, the Treasury borrowing for the last year, you'll see, of course, we run $300 billion deficits and things like that that the Treasury has to finance, and it does so by issuing Treasury bonds, which the market may or may not buy. What was unprecedented is during the last 90 days, the Treasury issued $1 trillion worth of bonds, thereby sucking up every dollar in circulation and creating a credit crunch. That they then came to the rescue and said, here's how we get out of it. So after causing the problem by borrowing almost every dollar in circulation and causing asset values to fall in the process, now the banks that own the New York Fed are going to be liquid like no other, and they're going to have the ability to fund private equity deals. So look for a wave of equity deals where institutions will borrow money from these banks and buy things like your utility company and your any manufacturing entities that are left in this country.
Here we go. Thanks, Andy. Andy's website, andygause.com, linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. A coroner in Britain has determined that a 12-year-old boy died after using too much spray deodorant in a confined space. Daniel Hurley collapsed in January after spraying on Lynx deodorant in the bathroom of his home. An inquest was told last week that a volatile agent in the deodorant upset the boy's heart rhythm. He was hospitalized after the incident. He died 5 days later from a cardiac arrhythmia, also known as abnormal heart rhythms, according to the report. A New York City woman is suing a local hospital after her lawyer says a horrible medical mistake led to the removal of both her hands and her feet. Quadruple amputee Tabitha Mullings was released from Brooklyn Hospital Center on Friday, where she originally was admitted 2 months ago for just a kidney stone. Mullings was given painkillers and sent home, but an infection that went untreated blocked blood flow to her hands and feet, and she lapsed into a semi-coma for 2 weeks. When the 32-year-old mother of three awoke, doctors told her they had to amputate both. How'd you like to wake up and have doctors say, "We had to amputate your hands and your feet"? She also lost sight in one eye. She's suing the hospital for $100 million. A Chinese man has been showing off his talent for blowing up balloons using only his eyes. You can see what he does on coasttocoastam.com by wearing a pair of specially made goggles. He blew up balloons to an audience's applause. In Portland, Oregon, Henry Markham has nothing but kind words for the dog that shot his 23-year-old son this weekend. Markham says his son Matthew was standing at a bay at the start of duck hunting when the dog jumped into a boat, setting off a 12-gauge shotgun. The blast blew a hole in the aluminum boat before hitting his son, who is now recovering from injuries to his legs and other parts of his body. Henry Markham said he's not angry with the dog, and neither is his son. He said it's a Labrador. His name is Drake, and it's just one of those things. And an Austrian motorist couldn't work out and figure out why his Mercedes car was purring along better than normal until he looked under the hood, and he discovered his neighbor's terrified cat had been perched on the engine block for nearly a week. There's a picture of the little cat hiding out there at coasttocoastam.com. And more people believe in aliens and ghosts than in God, according to a new survey. That's according to a British newspaper. The survey, however, was done by a marketing firm in conjunction with the release of an X-Files DVD. And details of how the poll was conducted were not reported in the Daily Mail. Survey questions, depending on how they were written, can greatly skew the results. The poll said of 3,000 people, that 58% believe in the supernatural, including paranormal encounters, while 54% believe God exists. In a moment, we're going to be talking about John Titor, the time traveler. What passed by the space shuttle Atlantis? What hovered over O'Hare Gate C-17? And other stories with Jim Mars, Above Top Secret, next on Coast to Coast AM. Jim Mars is an award-winning journalist. He's got more than 30 years' experience with several Texas newspapers. In 1999, he began teaching a course on UFOs, perhaps one of the first of the university level. He has investigated the U.S. Army's remote viewing program, and he has covered many major stories. I had an opportunity a few weeks ago at the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas to meet Jim Mars. Hey, Jim, how are you?
George, always a pleasure to be with you.
You were shooting by me as we were walking into the hotel for the event, but it was great to meet you, even as briefly as it was, Jimmy.
Well, it, was. It's always pretty hectic at those events. Maybe we'll have a chance to sit down and toss back a couple one day.
Yeah, we will do that. God, you did a great job with this story, this book, Above Top Secret, Uncover the Mysteries of the Digital Age. Tell me about the work, the research that went into this.
Well, this was one of the most interesting books I've ever produced, mostly because when they said I got together with the AboveTopSecret.com people. It's their website.
Good people.
They're one of the biggest on the whole internet. They got millions of subscribers, members. Nothing gets past them. Everything is debated. And, you know, that's really an exciting thing on the internet because too many blogs, too many newspapers, magazines, they have their own staff. They tell you what they want you to hear. And if they tell you something that's not necessarily true, you really have no recourse. You know, you just accept it or you don't. But on Above Top Secret, their motto is deny ignorance, okay? And everybody has a chance. And when somebody posts something, no matter how ridiculous it may sound, if it is indeed ridiculous, then plenty of other people jump in and say, that's ridiculous, and here's why. And so you really get to the bottom of things. So when the Above Top Secret folks came to me and said, we'd like you to write about all the biggest controversies, mysteries, conspiracies going on today, I thought, oh my God, George, can you imagine? I mean, each one of these topics could take two or three books, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm going, oh my Lord, I don't know. And they said, no. Said, you don't have to footnote this one. You don't have to nail everything down. You just tell people what is the issue and what do we know about it and what seems to make sense and what doesn't. So based on my some 50 years of experience in the news business, they're covering everything from military to foreign affairs to courts to police to you name it. And, of course, then off into the Kennedy assassination and the UFO field and everything else. I just thought, wow, this is really cool. I can just sit down and tell people here's what the issue is. And, George, I'll tell you what I did. I just went back to journalism school, basic journalism school,
yep,
when they said go for the who, what, when, where, and why. So here's what, here's who says it, here's what it means, here's why we need to pay attention to this, and then each chapter gives a little bit of an overview. So I don't want anybody to think that I'm going to solve the mysteries of UFOs or that I'm going to solve the Kennedy assassination, but when you read this new book, Above Top Secret, It's a primer on these issues, and you'll be well geared up and well armed to go and tackle these issues for yourself because you'll have that basic who, what, when, where, and why.
Yeah, it is. It's a good little research book for all these topics. We'll touch on a few of them tonight while we have you, Jim. Let's talk about something that's so topical right now, Jim Marrs, and that is, of course, the situation with the Federal Reserve, which you include in this book, Above Top Secret. I mean, here we are. Now, you know, we're told about a $700 billion bailout. Now we're talking about trillions of dollars that just keeps getting given away, our money, taxpayer money. And yet the Federal Reserve continues to do what it does. Is that a scam, as you looked into?
Well, let me put it this way. If you entrusted all of your money to some institution, and that institution had been in existence since 1913, and yet no one was ever able to audit that institution to find out how much money do they have, and what do they do with that money, and who controls that money? It kind of sounds like a scam to me. I mean, I'd like to know. Obviously, they haven't taken that public trust with the money too seriously, or we wouldn't be in the mess we're in, right?
So true.
And you have to understand that the Federal Reserve is neither federal, nor does it have any reserves. It's not even officially part of the government. It's 12 district banks or area banks.
The biggest, of course, is in New York.
In New York, which pretty well tells the rest of them what to do.
Yeah.
And then they're in turn owned by private banks, which are then owned by private owners and investors, many of whom are not even American citizens. So, and yet, and we can't audit it. I mean, this has been a sore point to true constitutional conservatives for decades, and yet nothing seems to be done about it. But today, after we see how they've just wrecked the economy of this country and then expect the taxpayers to bail them out, I think it's time we take a serious look at the Federal Reserve system.
I do, too. I think this situation is abominable, Jim, with what's going on right under our eyes and the illusion that they're saving these banks when actually what they're doing is lining the purse strings of their friends.
Exactly.
And you know, we taxpayers sit back and we think, oh my gosh, we've saved another big bank from a disaster. No, they are taking money. They are pillaging us.
We are bailing out private industry. Now, when did we ever start that? George, if you and I owned a corporation and we were selling cars, okay? And our cars proved to be defective, who's held responsible? We are.
Yep.
And if our company goes broke, as many car companies have, then, you know, who's at fault? The people that run the car company, okay? They either made bad investments or bad choices. They did something. And in a free and equal capitalist business environment, you take the risk, you reap the profits, and you also take the hits when something bad happens. Where is it written that these people can make these god-awful financial decisions, and then it's up to us taxpayers to pull their fat out of the fire?
This past Saturday was the JFK assassination weekend anniversary. Ian Punnett did a show on that. I didn't have an opportunity to because the 22nd fell on Saturday.
Right.
You have investigated JFK, and you've done a pretty thorough job. Why, after all these years, 45 years now, Jim, 45 years, why is it still so important for us to try to get to the bottom of this?
Because it ties right back into your first question. We can't possibly understand what's happening to us as a nation today unless we understand what happened to us as a nation 45 years ago. And just to bring you up to one small tidbit, there has been some excellent research done using White House transcripts of White House telephone calls and messages that were only released going back into the early 90s. And what it shows is the idea of the Warren Commission was not even Lyndon Johnson's idea. He actually really didn't want a commission. He didn't really want anybody investigating or looking in to what really happened to his predecessor, John F. Kennedy. But he was persuaded to form the Warren Commission by men who were members of the Council on Foreign Relations who were connected to Wall Street.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and then they put together the commission, and they had some politicians on there like Hale Boggs and John Cooper, Gerald Ford, who were just, you know, politicians, who whichever way the wind blows, that's which way they're going to go. The two most prominent people on the Warren Commission were John J. McCloy, who had been CEO of National City Bank, which is now Citicorp, and Alan Dulles, who had been fired as head of the CIA by Kennedy and who had been closely associated to Wall Street. In fact, both Dulles and his mentor, John J. McCloy, were two of the American bankers and Wall Street executives who were most prominent in lending money and support to Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. Holy cow. I mean, it's just, unless you understand what's happened here. And then, so here are the people who basically created Hitler and the Nazis, along with their corporate buddies in IBM, Thomas Watson, and in the Union Banking Corporation, Prescott Bush, American Hamburg Steamship Line. And in 1931, when Germany was trying to put together a democratic and free republic, the Weimar Republic, it was these people who then pulled the plug out from under, the rug out from under the German economy by withholding loans, by calling in loans, and they did the same thing to Germany they are now doing to us.
Jim, stay with us because I want to talk with you about the Stephenville, Texas UFO case and also the case that the UFO hunters just did on the History Channel just a few days ago. We'll be back in a moment with Jim Mars on Coast to Coast AM. Well, happy holidays because we're still giving you that double CD, Art Bell's Interviews Classics with the late Father Malachi Martin, when you renew or subscribe the After Dark magazine. Call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. Or go online at coast2coasttocoastam.com. Jim Mars, let's talk about some UFOs. We'll talk about John Teeter as well and so many other subjects you've got here later on tonight. We'll take some phone calls with Jim Mars. We started him early. Jim, UFO sightings around Stephenville, Texas, one of our programs with the Sci-Fi Network. Incredible story. You've looked at that, huh?
Yes, that's right. In fact, let me tell you, they're still going on right now.
Yeah.
They're still having sightings down there, and of course, it's not getting the nationwide attention that it did back at the first of the year. But it's still going on. And I'll tell you, one of the things that just blows my mind, and I think you'll blow yours too, is that working with the state director of MUFON and other investigators, they managed to get hold of the radar data for that area back at the first of the year when they were sighting all these things, lights in the sky, things moving around.
Yeah.
And they found one very, very large object that was moving towards the south at 37 miles an hour. Now, George, you don't have to be an aviation expert to know that no solid object can stay in the air at 37 miles an hour.
No, it'll drop right to the ground.
Below airspeed.
Yeah.
So
I can walk that fast, almost.
Right. Now, and you mentioned before the break about the Aurora story. I've been bursting to tell people the news about Aurora, because I worked with the History Channel folks back in the summer on this story, but it was their show, and they had the scientific investigation going on, and they, you know, asked that I and others not talk about it until their show aired.
Right,
well,
right.
Now it's aired. And for those of listeners, I'll just recap it briefly, because
sure.
I think this is the smoking gun of the UFO issue. All these years, people say, well, it's a secret government test craft, or it's misidentified aircraft. Oh, they just saw a satellite going by. Okay? So I always thought, wouldn't it be great if there was really a very well-documented UFO incident prior to anything man-made being in the air? And this is it. Aurora, Texas, 1897, 6 years before the Wright brothers flew. And 6 years before there was powered balloon flight in the United States, there was nothing man-made in the air. And
nothing.
Yet, the Dallas Morning News and the Old Fort Worth Record, which was the forerunner of my old newspaper, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, all carried stories that on April the 17th, a large silver cigar-shaped object crashed in Aurora, Texas. And in the story, it states that the pilot of the ship is supposed to have been the only one on board, and while his remains are badly disfigured, enough of the original has been picked up to show that he was not an inhabitant of this world.
Oh, my God. And that was in the paper.
That was
in the paper.
That was in the Dallas Morning News, which is still in publication. Now, they said that this non-human pilot was buried in the Aurora Cemetery. And that's the story. And that was the story that I picked up way back in the early 70s when I first got onto this story. And at that time, there were still three people alive who had been alive in the Aurora area in 1897. One lady said it was all a hoax, but then by her own account, she had no direct knowledge of it. Somebody came by, told her father about it, and he laughed and said, oh, that old Judge Proctor, he's such a joker. So based on that, she said it was a hoax. Another lady had no direct knowledge, but she said she remembers her parents running into town and coming back and telling her about all this wreckage. So she indicated that something had actually happened. And then I talked to Charlie Stevens, and he said as a young boy, he was out early that morning doing the chores with his dad, and he actually saw the thing go over, heard the explosion, and saw the smoke coming up from Aurora. So based on that, plus a lot of other information, I began to think there really was something to this. But the debunker said, no, it was just a hoax story placed in the newspaper trying to draw attention to the town because the railroad had bypassed it and it was dying on the vine. It was all a hoax. There was no grave in the cemetery. There was no debris found there anywhere. And, of course, by all accounts, everybody came from miles around and picked up the metal and hauled it away. One person I interviewed said his grandfather told him that law enforcement people showed up and were loading pieces of this metal onto wagons and hauling it off. One of the first crash retrievals, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's kind of where the story's been. You know, some people think it happened. Some people think it didn't happen. And what they've done now with the scientific investigation is show that, yes, they found the supports for the windmill. There was a windmill, or at least a windlass, a derrick tower that was used to haul the sump up for the sump pump in this well, which is at the location. And they finally uncovered the concrete, and sure enough, there was a well there.
What about the grave and the headstones and things like that,
they
Jim?
Did ground-penetrating radar, and they found that, indeed, there was a grave at that site. And, of course, the headstone's been missing since 1973. I'm one of the few people left who actually saw the little headstone while it was in position. And, George, I'll tell you, it was rounded on one end and then kind of sharply cut off on the other as though it had been broken in half. But on the half that was still there was an inverted V shape with little circles in the center. And I've always thought that if you extrapolate that design over to the other side, you're going to have a cigar-shaped a saucer object with little portholes
right
along the side. Now, here's the clincher, though. They found around the area of the well where the crash reportedly took place molted aluminum. But this aluminum did not match the metal composition of modern aluminum. And it was like little globs of it, as though it had been melted. And it was embedded in 100-year-old trees and in rocks and in the soil. And the scientists said that is evidence of a tremendous explosion. So there was a grave. There was a windmill, or at least a derrick there. And there was this metal that gives evidence of an explosion. The Aurora spaceship story, which I covered extensively in my book, Alien Agenda, has been proven to be essentially true.
Who do you think ran off with the remains of this creature?
Well, I have talked to at least four or five separate people who live in and around the Aurora area, because I don't live very far from that myself. In fact, some of the people that I went to church with up there in Boyd live in that Aurora area. And they said, and different people over different times, said in the 50s, in the 70s, in the 80s, and even in the 90s, they had encountered federal government agents in that cemetery. So
just what I suspect.
Exactly what you thought. They've gone in there. It's like Roswell all over again. They have picked up every little piece of evidence that they could find, and they thought they had it pretty well covered, but they missed the little globs because it had been cemented over when the well had been covered over.
Gosh, it is a remarkable case, Jim.
It really is.
And you know, the fact that there were consistencies of events. You know, you've got to piece it together. You know, and I was told a long time ago, said, George, it doesn't matter if you can't find, 1,000 pink rabbits in the field to admit that there's one. All you got to do is find one. Yep.
And when you find a half dozen, then you know somewhere there's a bunch of pink rabbits.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the Phoenix case, 1997. You looked into this.
Oh, yes. That was a very interesting case, too. That happened in March of 1997, and I remember that quite clearly because I was going to several different speaking engagements. And right before I left Fort Worth, there was a story in the Star-Telegram, and it actually made the news, TV news also, about a UFO that was seen over Saginaw, Texas. And the reason that this picture actually ended up in the newspaper without a bunch of snickering and fun-making was that it happened to have been taken by the Star-Telegram's own staff photographer. And so they ran it, and it was a pretty – and the TV, too, ran it fairly straight-faced and said, gee, I wonder what this is. So with that story fresh in my mind, I went to Atlanta. And when I got to Atlanta, they were having a big story on their local TV about some guy who had gotten some home movie video footage of a UFO. And it was pretty good footage. And they, too, were playing it pretty straight-faced. It's like, gee, wonder what this is. And then, of course, I find out that in Phoenix, they had this huge thing fly over the city because my brother at that time lived in Phoenix. And I heard all about this. So here were three things happening in Fort Worth, Atlanta, and in Phoenix all at the same time. And yet nobody heard about any of that because it never goes anywhere because that is the control over the media. They can't control the reports, but they can control the distribution of the information. In fact, it was not until about June that the story about Phoenix finally broke in the national media, and that's because USA Today did a big story on it. And at that time, it kind of blew up into a big story, and everybody was trying to say, gee, wonder what it was. And, of course, by that time, they had laid down their cover story. Why, it was just military flares dropped by the Maryland State Guard. And so reporters called up the Maryland State Guard, and they said, yes, we did. We flew out there, and we dropped some military flares over the Barry Goldwater Gunnery Range about 10 o'clock that night. And so everybody goes, oh, well, okay, so it's just military flares. We can forget about that. And poor dumb reporters, I don't know what's happened to reporters these days, but they didn't seem to catch the fact that the big thing that flew over Phoenix and was seen by thousands of people and videotaped happened at 8:30 at night. Yes, and then there were some lights at 10 o'clock, and apparently there were some military flares at 10 o'clock. But just think how easy that was. Sometime after 8:30, somebody said, we've got to have a cover story. So somebody calls the Maryland State Guard and tells them to go out there and drop some flares, which they do. And then later, of course, they can say, well, it was military flares. And yes, it was. But that wasn't what the people in Phoenix saw. Now, the end of that story is that the governor of Arizona at that time, Fife Symington, held a news conference and tried to brush the whole thing off. In fact, he said, I think we found who's behind this. And he brought out an aide dressed in a green alien suit. And everybody laughed and rolled their eyes. And it was like, oh, boy. And that was kind of the end of that. Just this year, Fife Symington.
Oh, yeah. I was on CNN with him.
You were with him. And now he's changed his tune. Now he says, well, I did that because I didn't want to start a panic. He said, but I saw it myself, and it was unearthly. It was a spaceship. Right?
You got it.
So there we go, folks. You have to keep up with these stories, and you have to think for yourself.
And, you know, he had at the original news conference back in 1997, I think he had someone come in with an alien costume on.
Yeah.
And he did his little spoof.
Yeah, made a big joke out of it.
Yeah, and he really regretted doing that. And what a turnaround. He reminded me, when I met Fife, and I've met him a couple times now, he reminded me of Dr. Hynek when Alan Hynek did his turnaround. Remember, Jim, when he started off with his theory of swamp gas?
Right.
And he realized, you know what, this is not going to cut it. And he made a complete turnaround.
I actually interviewed Hynek way back then as a young reporter, and he had already changed his story by then, and he was quite adamant about that there was a real issue there and UFOs were real. And I was quite shocked and amazed when I went back and read some of his earlier stuff where, for example, when hundreds of people up in Michigan saw this UFO, he got the whole state in an uproar by holding a news conference and say all they had seen was swamp gas.
He did. He drove everybody nuts. Everybody nuts when he said that. But you know what? He stepped up to the plate like Symington did and admitted he was wrong. And he never looked back after that, Jim.
That's true. That's true. And like I said, by the time I interviewed him, he was quite forthright about the whole thing.
John Teeter, an incredible story of a time traveler, maybe, who has made some uncanny predictions of the future that could come true. Tell me about your investigation into him.
Well, that is really an interesting case, because did you read that when it began to appear on the...
It started off on Art Bell's website, and then other blogs, Oliver Williams is a fellow now who keeps the JohnTeter.com website alive. But it was an incredible series of postings, and then he faded away. John Teeter did. Faded away.
Huh. Yes. Well, at a certain point, I think it ended in March of 2001. But from November 2000 to March 2001, there are all these postings, and again, for the listeners who don't even know what we're talking about, during that time period between November 2000 and March of 2001, there was some postings on the internet, and I believe it started with Art Bell's site, didn't it? Right.
Yep.
And this guy claimed to be a time traveler, and he said he came from the future.
2036.
2036. That's correct. And he had only stopped by in this time period because he wanted to see about picking up some old family photographs and some personal stuff from his family. And as I recall, the story was that he was after some kind of a computer from this period of time because it was still using old computer code that they needed in the future because they had some computer codes in the future that they couldn't quite figure out, or they had old codes that they couldn't figure out, and they were needing it. Had something to do with computers, and there were some photographs he published that supposedly was his time machine, but if you looked, it looked like an old Chevrolet or a 1960s Chevrolet Corvette. He said he had mounted the time machine in this Corvette. So, of course, on the face of it, that sounds patently ridiculous. But there was just a certain quality to Teeter's account that certainly struck me, and it struck a lot of other people, and that's why there's still a lot of people who are claiming that, so he went back into time, and that's why we haven't heard from him. And, of course, you've always got your naysayers who'll say, well, it was just a total hoax. Except if you keep up with cutting-edge quantum physics, as I do and a lot of others do, some of the things he was talking about actually made some sense. And I think the biggest thing that they got onto the Teeter story about was that they said here it was his last comments, and he tried to tell everybody what was going to happen. And I think the big thing was that there was a nuclear war in 2015 that pretty well devastated a whole bunch of everything, although it didn't totally destroy the United States because, as I recall, he said that he was living in Florida in 2036. So, obviously, some portion of Florida was still okay. But he talked about this nuclear war, and yet people jumped him because this was in March of 2000, and he never made any mention of the 9/11 attacks. But, George, if you stop and think about it, do you remember the attack on the Polish radio station?
Yes.
It was a German radio station on the Polish border.
Right.
And the Poles reportedly attacked it. Okay, well, you know your history, so you kind of remember that story, but most people don't know what I'm talking about. But that sparked World War II. And so just, if he had lived, just for the sake of argument, if he had lived in a future that had experienced a nuclear war, then the 3,000 casualties of 9/11 probably wouldn't stand out in his mind very much, right?
That's a good point. Jim, stay with us. Much more to talk with you about. And then we're going to open up the phone lines at the halfway mark for another hour with Jim Mars, because then, later on tonight, we're going live to Egypt to talk with Zahi Hawass about the pyramids, about the Sphinx, and about more research. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.